From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air.
Days ago, I was with my family. Now you tell me all is lost.
The new film, 12 Years a Slave, is based on the memoir by Solomon Northup, a free black man in New York who was kidnapped in 1841 and sold into slavery in the Deep South. Today we talk with the film's star, Chiwetel Ejiofor, and its director, Steve McQueen. McQueen is British. His ancestors were slaves in the West Indies.
I mean, the only difference I would say that anything between myself and African American is their boat went right and my boat went left.
We'll also talk with David Blight, director of the Center for the Study of Slavery, Resistance, and Abolition at Yale.
We love being the country that freed the slaves. We're not so fond of being the country that
owned them, right.
That had the biggest slave system on the planet.
That's coming up on Fresh Air. First News. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The new movie, 12 Years a Slave, was described by David Denby in The New Yorker as easily the greatest feature film ever made about American slavery. My guests are the star of the film, Chiwetel Ejiofor, and its director, Steve McQueen. The movie is adapted from the 1853 memoir by Solomon Northup. Northup had been a free black man in upstate New York. A husband and father, he was literate. He was a working man who also made money as a fiddler. But in 1841, after being lured to Washington, D.C., with the promise of several days' work fiddling with the circus, he was kidnapped into slavery. Over the next 12 years, before finally winning his freedom, he became the property of a series of different plantation owners, one who was especially cruel and brutal. Chiwetel Ejiofor's other films include Dirty Pretty Things, Kinky Boots, and Children of Men. He's now starring in Dancing on the Edge, the new Stars Network series about a black bandleader in London in the 1930s. Director Steve McQueen's other films are Shame, about a sex addict, and Hunger, based on the story of Bobby Sands, who died leading a hunger strike of imprisoned IRA members protesting their treatment. Let's start with a clip from 12 Years a Slave, just after Solomon Northup has been kidnapped and sold to slave traders and is on a ship heading toward Louisiana. He's talking to other slaves on the ship.
Days ago, I was with my family in my home. Now you tell me all is lost. Tell no one who I am. That's the way to survive. Well, I don't want to survive. I want to live.
Steve McQueen, Chiwetel Ejiofor, welcome to Fresh Air. Steve McQueen, let me start with you. Why did you want to make a film adaptation of a memoir by a free man from the North who was kidnapped into slavery? Why did you choose that book?
Well, what happened originally is I had an idea of having a free man from the North, because I was just thinking about ideas and how I can have an in into the narrative. A free man from the North who gets kidnapped and pulled into the maze of slavery. And I like the idea that the audience follows this person in every step that he takes within the context of slavery, just to illuminate what that world was. And I was having a bit of difficulty. I was working with John Ridley on the script. We were having a little bit of difficulty. And my wife said to me, well, why don't you look into first-hand accounts of slavery? I thought, oh, yeah, of course. And she did some research. And I did some research. But she found this book called 12 Years a Slave. And I read this book, and I was totally stunned. It was like something sort of a bolt coming out of the sky. And at the same time, I was pretty upset with myself that I didn't know this book. How come I did not know this book? And slowly but surely, I realized that most people, in fact, all the people I knew, did not know this book. And, you know, I live in Amsterdam, where Anne Frank is a national hero. She's not just a national hero, she's a world hero. And for me, this book read like Anne Frank's diary, but written 97 years before, a first-hand account of slavery. And I basically made it my passion to make this book into a film.
Steve McQueen, I know one of your parents is from Grenada and one from Trinidad. So they're both from islands in the Caribbean. Were their ancestors slaves, do you know?
Yes, of course, yes. They were slaves. My trajectory as such of being introduced to slavery was fairly immediate because my parents were from the West Indies. And, you know, at school there was references to slavery, but not much. So it's one of those things which I found out through my parents and obviously traveling back to the West Indies. And I have a family tree going back to the first African on my mother's side who came from Ghana. So it's one of those things which I had definitely had the connection with. The only difference I would say that anything between myself and African American is their boat went right and my boat went left.
Chiwetel Ejiofor, your parents are from Nigeria. I know your father is no longer alive, but did they tell you anything about what they learned about the slave trade from an African perspective?
Well, my father was a great believer in the ideas of African kind of diaspora, of a sense of unity amongst African people and people of African heritage, and that's what I, that was the attitude, I suppose, that I grew up with, that we were all united in this almost by this thing, even though we were then spread across the world because of it, you know. So that was their attitude. They were also aware of the number of people from Nigeria who were taken out of Nigeria, and the Bight of Benin, and taken over to America and to the West Indies. This all was kind of came to me very specifically when I was in Calabar, when I was in Nigeria, and I was at the slave museum in Calabar, finishing a film there. And on my last day, because I was heading over down towards Louisiana to start shooting on this, I went to the slave museum, and there with the list, these roll calls of people, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people taken out of that area. And so, you know, being of Nigerian heritage, going over to Louisiana, you just start to feel connected to the whole sense of it, to the international nature of it, to the complete sort of absence of humanity that surrounded it.
I think of 12 Years a Slave as a very experiential film, and it's much more about Solomon Northup's experience as a slave than it is about, like, the larger historical context of slavery. And should we tell Ejiofor what that meant for you, is that you're going to be doing a lot of suffering on camera. I mean, you know, your body is put through so much. And I'm, you know, just like one example is early in the film when after you're kidnapped, you are beaten with a plank of wood and beaten so hard that the wood breaks. There's whippings and you're hanging. And were you uncomfortable about the idea of taking on a role in which you knew you'd have to endure so much suffering? Because I'm sure, even though obviously you weren't really physically injured in the way that your character is, you emotionally had to experience that to the extent that you're capable of as an actor.
Yeah, those aspects of the film they're very necessary to kind of understand Solomon's psychological journey, you know, to understand who he is, what he's endured, and actually in a wider sense, what people endured in that time. And I think that it gave audiences and gives audiences a chance to really understand the inner workings of what's happening. And so, you know, those sequences ended up having a sense of privilege about them, actually. I think if you're playing somebody, if you're playing a real person, you're always seeking to, in a way, legitimize your relationship with that person, you know, to have the right to tell their story. And I felt that sometimes when we were doing things that Solomon describes in the book that he went through, and we were recreating these moments as accurately as we could, and that would mean me being uncomfortable, what it meant was it sort of legitimized our relationship, and it made it easier for me to walk with him and to tell his story.
There's a scene I want to ask you about that's a real kind of emotional turning point for Solomon Northup in the film. He is forced to whip a young woman who he's very fond of, and he knows that if he doesn't whip her, that the slave master will do it. So, like, he figures, you know, he'll whip her lightly, but he can't get away with that. The slave owner demands a harsher whipping, and I think that would be a very telling point in the emotional life of Solomon Northup. And I was wondering if you could each talk about what that scene meant to you, that he was put in the position of knowing that things would be even worse if he didn't whip her himself.
Well, I think, you know, this is what we're talking about. I mean, this is why people were kept in captivity for 400 years, because of those kind of events. This is a true event. So what happens at that scene is that, you know, Epps, the slave master you're talking about, says to him, if he doesn't do it, he will kill everyone here. What choice does he have? I mean, these are kind of choices that have been made, unfortunately, throughout history, throughout the most horrendous moments in history, that people do in order to survive.
It's almost, you know, the thing is that it's not necessarily what Epps, the plantation owner, is going for. He's not necessarily doing this in order to hurt Solomon psychologically. He is going through his own crisis in the sense that he is in love with this girl, with Patsy, his slave girl. And he is in such kind of conflict and anger and self-hatred about that, that in the moment, even though he wants to whip her, he can't. And he's unable to do it, which is why he sort of almost casually turns to Solomon and orders him to. And then what that does, of course, to Solomon is this: it's that sort of it's the physical and the psychological, and that is, I think, what is always in balance and always in play in these places, in these scenes, and in the book, and in the way that Solomon describes what is happening, is that there's the physical aspect of it, but there's also the psychological. And in a way, I think that Solomon was able to, at that point, had found ways of protecting himself from Master Epps, of protecting himself physically, from protecting himself emotionally, from protecting himself psychologically. But this was something else. This was something he did not envisage, that he would have to be forced to participate in injuring somebody that he cared so deeply about. So it's in a sense, it just speaks to all the levels of captivity and the three-dimensional nature of what was going on.
My guests are Chiwetel Ejiofor, the star of the new film 12 Years a Slave, and Steve McQueen, the film's director. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Steve McQueen, the director of the new film 12 Years a Slave, and Chiwetel Ejiofor, who is the star of the film. He plays Solomon Northup, a free man from the North who's kidnapped into slavery in the South and is forced to be a slave for 12 years until he manages to get out. Steve McQueen, you might really disagree with me on this, but having seen all three of your movies, Hunger, about Bobby Sands, who's played by Michael Fassbender. I mean, Michael Fassbender is absolutely skeletal by the time the movie ends. And then Michael Fassbender stars again in Shame, in which he's I guess you'd call him a sex addict, but it's hard to say if he gets any pleasure out of sex. I mean, it's a compulsion that he has to follow.
Well, after a while, most addicts don't get pleasure.
Yes,
out of
exactly.
What they do.
Exactly.
Becomes a necessity.
Exactly. And now 12 Years a Slave, in which there's, you know, again, very physical suffering. And so I can't help but think there's something that interests you about psychic and physical suffering, and that your movies are all about the body in some way, you know, the hunger strike, the sexual compulsion, the physical endurance of somebody who is a slave, but their body and spirit manages to survive.
No, listen, I'm interested in, you know, the hunger strike. It was the biggest thing politically that happened in Britain in the past 27 years. 10 men dying of hunger in a British prison cell. It was deafening, but no one was speaking about it. That's why I made the picture. As far as Shame is concerned, this phenomenon about sex addiction, and I wanted to investigate that, because it's something that everyone has a relationship with, sex. And it was, again, it was this elephant in the room. And that's what I wanted to make the picture about, because it was about this addiction, which has been sort of, has been thriving also due to the internet. And slavery, well, I mean, I don't know how obvious you could be. I mean, all you got to do is walk down the street and you see the evidence of slavery in everyday life, but there's a huge silence about it. It's a deafening silence about it. You know, why are the prison population of black males so huge? Why is poverty in black communities so huge? Why is mental health? Why is education so poor? Why? And when you ask yourself that question, it all leads down to what happened in slavery, because no one has, you know, once it has stopped, you know, everyone was left to get on with their own devices, but without a platform, without a leg up. And there you have the evidence of slavery. So these are huge events, deafening events, which I feel needed a platform. And the only platform for me as an artist was cinema, because for me it's the greatest art form there is. The question is, you know, why hasn't there been a film like this on slavery?
One of the things that you do in some of your movies, and certainly in 12 Years a Slave, is have scenes last a little longer than we'd expect. And because things are edited so quickly now. I mean, like, there's a lot of movies that are, scenes last for such a short period of time, and the same goes for a lot of TV shows, particularly comedy series now. And there are a few scenes, without mentioning them by name, in which something terrible is being endured, and just as we think, like, oh, the scene's going to end, it doesn't. And you keep our eye on that scene longer than we expected, and longer than is comfortable, which I think is very intentional on your part, because you want it to be more uncomfortable than just, it's another movie scene.
But also to be present. I think it's not just, yes, those are the sort of fundamentals of it, but what it's to do is to do with being present as a viewer, to being there, to shoot things in real time rather than movie time. So for example, the sequence where Patsy's getting whipped, that we spoke about before, to be present within that, and to sort of that shot, I think it's 10 minutes, to be present in that is to sort of lose the frame and to hold the tension and to not, you know, to be there in a kind of reality. That's what I want. That was the chosen effect that I wanted. And it works, for me, it works in a way because it doesn't allow the viewer off the hook.
In shooting the movie, Steve McQueen, you have an incredible eye in making films. And I'm wondering if you referred to daguerreotype photographs or old paintings or any other historical artifacts to...
It was the state of Louisiana. It was New Orleans. It was those plantations. It was that sort of, myself and Sean Barnett, my cameraman, who were working with for 13 years. It was just the environment, the landscape that sort of was so rich, that it just lent to so many ideas and images. You know, as we went in there naked and came out there fully clothed, it was just amazing how, you know, you just look at things and you find things in that environment. It was so rich. And of course, like I said, you know, before, the most beautiful, horrible things happen in the most beautiful places. It was just so rich. And the sound of the cicadas, they almost act like a choir at certain points. I mean, it was kind of amazing, amazing.
Did you see, besides being on the former plantations in Louisiana where you shot, did you see any other artifacts of slavery that survive?
Yes. Yes, we saw the actual slave shacks. There were a lot of slave shacks which are still there, which they were vacated. I mean, what happened was that after the slave shacks were built, they were there. So what happened was, I think people actually lived in them for a while, and I think that they were like vacated during the sort of late 70s. I think lots of people were living in them since the late 70s, but they were there. And you had these shotgun houses there, still there too. It was pretty incredible. It's a shame that they're not being looked after very well. Of course, they're being left to sort of the elements. But there you have it.
So, in getting back to the idea that you want us to experience what slavery was like, and I think that happens, and it's difficult to endure. It's a very painful film to watch because you are putting yourself as a viewer in the shoes of Solomon Northup. And what makes it, you know, especially easy, I think, for everybody to do that is he starts as a free man. And you know, like, well, you're a free person, he was a free person, and imagine what it would be like to suddenly be a slave. I mean, it's just so easy to identify whether you are descended from a slave or not. But there's so much suffering that you endure secondhand in watching the movie. And I guess I'm wondering, where is the line for you between, like, how much you want to put your audience through and how much is just going to be, like, a little too much for a film? Did you Is that the kind of thing you think about when setting out to make a film like this?
Well, yeah, I think if you read the book, it's a lot. It's too much. And actually, there are 5 acts of violence in the whole film. 5. In 2 hours and 11 minutes. But it's to do with the context. And that's the issue, because I think people don't want to think of the past. They would rather be blind than to sort of look at what the evidence of things which are around them. People don't want that responsibility. They would rather look at a horror movie or a thriller and people get shot in the head every 15 minutes. But, you know, I feel that, you know, it's like looking at Schindler's List or looking at The Pianist or looking at whatever Holocaust film there is. That's our responsibility as humans, to sort of reflect on our recent past in order to find out where we are and where we're going. Particularly with this particular subject, because it seems that there's a huge sort of, I wouldn't say ambivalence, I would just say a huge sort of not wanting to look at oneself, but it's important.
Well, I want to thank you both so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much.
Chiwetel Ejiofor stars in the new film 12 Years a Slave. Steve McQueen directed the film. We'll talk with a historian about slavery in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
The Neubauer Family Foundation supports WHYY's Fresh Air and its commitment to sharing ideas and encouraging meaningful conversation. Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Novo Nordisk, committed to diabetes care and changing lives for more than 90 years. NovoNordisk-US.com. From Rhodes Scholar, offering travel adventures for people who love to learn, at roadscholar.org. Think outside the tour. And from Progressive Insurance, with more than 30,000 local independent agents. Information available at progressive.com. This is NPR.
Coming up, the importance of slave narratives, like Solomon Northup's 1853 memoir, 12 Years a Slave, which was just adapted into a new film. We talk with David Blight, director of the Center for the Study of Slavery, Resistance, and Abolition at Yale. He says Northup was kidnapped into slavery at a time when there was an insatiable demand for slave labor in the South. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. After seeing the new movie 12 Years a Slave, based on the memoir by Solomon Northup, a free black man in upstate New York who was kidnapped into slavery in 1841 and won his freedom 12 years later, I wanted to learn more about where this memoir fit in the genre of slave narratives, and I wanted to hear more about that period of slavery. Here to talk about that and more is David Blight, the director of the Center for the Study of Slavery, Resistance, and Abolition at Yale University. His 2007 book, A Slave No More, includes the recently discovered narratives of 2 former slaves. Blight is currently writing a biography of Frederick Douglass, who, after escaping slavery, wrote perhaps the most famous and important of all slave memoirs, and became an influential abolitionist. David Blight, welcome back to Fresh Air. Let's start with what you think the importance is of Solomon Northup's memoir.
Well, Solomon Northup's memoir tells this quite unusual story of the kidnapping of a free Northern African American and his enslavement in the Deep South, indeed Louisiana, on two, three different kinds of plantations. And in his narrative, another thing that makes it so distinctive is he's not only exhibiting an extraordinary memory of names, details, and places, but it's also a narrative that gives us a window into the kinds of labor, the kinds of economies that existed on these huge, brutal cotton and sugar plantations. So we don't have that many narratives, in fact, there are very few, that actually tell the story of what it was actually like on a huge cotton operation or a huge sugar operation in the Deep South.
What's an example of something that you learned from the memoir that you didn't know about slaves' lives on plantations?
Well, the daily grind of a cotton operation, the daily brutal physical labor of going into a cotton field, whether that's the sowing of the cotton, the caring of the cotton, and especially the picking of cotton. Picking cotton is almost a metaphor for most Americans, but in this book you actually learn a great deal about how brutal that kind of labor was. You also learn the same thing about sugar production in the swamps. Solomon Northup spent most of his time of those 12 years on two plantations in the Red River Valley, the Red River District of Louisiana. And it is a particularly profound and unusual window into that district of the Old South, of Louisiana, and of slave labor. The Northup narrative is particularly important as well because it has remarkable scenes that take place in the New Orleans slave market, which was the largest slave market in North America, the infamous New Orleans slave market. And indeed, the head slave trader in that market in the movie is played by Paul Giamatti, and he plays that role rather frighteningly well. One gets a sense from those scenes of just how much slaves were utterly commodities, physical commodities in the slave trade. And that's, of course, what happens to Solomon Northup in this tale.
There's a scene in the movie adaptation, 12 Years a Slave, right after the character has been kidnapped, when he's in some kind of, I don't know, holding cell or prison that's really in the shadow of the Capitol. He's in Washington, and you can see the Capitol building from his cell. And it's easy to forget that Washington, D.C. had slaves.
Oh, indeed. Washington, D.C. had slaves. Washington, D.C. had a slave pen and a slave market about 3 to 4 blocks from the U.S. Capitol. In fact, the primary slave market in D.C. at that time was located roughly where Union Station is today, the Great Train Station, which is not a 3-block walk from the Capitol. That was a very effective scene, I thought, in the film, when they managed to depict the Capitol in the distance. He was jailed there in Washington, D.C. for, I forget how long, a period of at least a few days. And it's there where he was first brutally whipped and reminded that he was then a slave and no longer a free man.
How common was the kidnapping of free African Americans from the North?
Well, not terribly common in terms of numbers, but it did happen. And one of the reasons that's happened is the domestic slave trade in the United States, the selling of slaves within the borders of the United States, just booms in huge numbers in the 18-teens, in the 1820s, and the 1830s, and the 1840s. So when Solomon Northup is seized, kidnapped in 1841, and sold down through Washington, D.C. to a trader who then sells him again onto a ship, and off they go to New Orleans to the great slave market. It's part of a huge business all over the American South, with dozens and dozens and dozens of full-time slave traders making tremendous livings in places like Washington, D.C., but especially in places like Richmond, Virginia, Norfolk, Virginia, Charleston, South Carolina, and other places along the northern rim of the South. The domestic slave trade moved approximately 1 million African Americans from the East Coast, the Upper South, into the Deep South from about 1820 to the Civil War in 1860. And part of that reason is, I mean, it becomes obvious, I suppose, that part of the reason is the great cotton boom of the lower Mississippi Valley. This is the place from Georgia across to Alabama to Mississippi and to Louisiana and East Texas. That's where the cotton kingdom boomed between 1820 and 1860. And through those four decades, roughly, there was an insatiable demand for slave labor. So most of the slaves transported in the domestic slave trade were already slaves. They were not kidnapped. But because the need was so great, this work of bounty hunters, this work of people trying to find black folk they could seize, especially males, increased over the course of the 1820s, 30s, and 40s. So it is not that unusual that somebody would find a Solomon Northup and try to get him into some scam and enslave him. Although the numbers of actual free blacks kidnapped, we don't have any precise numbers on them, but they would probably be in the hundreds, possibly in the small thousands.
One of the problems Solomon Northup has after he's kidnapped into slavery is that he has no proof that he's a free man. And, you know, there are papers that free African Americans in the North are supposed to have to prove that they are really free. He had those papers. Those papers were destroyed when he was kidnapped into slavery. Right. And I'm not sure I knew that these papers existed. So tell us a little bit about what these papers declaring your freedom were.
Well, they're not unlike what we might today call a birth certificate. They were a paper issued either by a court or a city or a town that declared that you were born free, that your mother was free. And for free blacks in the North, especially in certain regions, these were terribly important documents because they could protect them from kidnapping or enslavement. Solomon Northup did apparently have such papers, but of course they were taken or destroyed. So when he is sold in D.C. into a jail and sold onto a ship and sent down to Louisiana and out onto those godforsaken plantations, he not only has no documentation, but what good it would have done him there is another matter. He's in extremely remote areas. And from his narrative, and the film plays this up, he was very, very careful never to say what his real identity was. Apparently for fear that he might, if his masters believed him, they might sell him away again, sell him further away, who knows. But then we've also got a tale here, of course, about literacy, because he was literate enough to be able to write these letters and to communicate or and continue to attempt to communicate with the outside world and especially with people in New York who could give him legal assistance.
My guest is David Blight, the director of the Center for the Study of Slavery, Resistance, and Abolition at Yale University. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is David Blight. He's the director of the Center for the Study of Slavery, Resistance, and Abolition at Yale, and he edited two slave narratives. He's working on a biography of Frederick Douglass. We're talking about some of the historical context for the movie 12 Years a Slave, which is based on the memoir of the same name by Solomon Northup. Solomon Northup is told after he's kidnapped not to let anybody know that he's literate, that he can read, that he can write, because that's just going to get him into trouble. Why would that get him into trouble?
A literate slave was a dangerous slave. A literate slave could read newspapers. A literate slave was always more intelligent, or deemed more intelligent, by the master class and by overseers. It's at the heart. It's one of the great threads of Frederick Douglass's autobiographies as well. The place that literacy plays in the life of a slave as a source of some kind of power. The ability to read about the outside world, the ability to communicate with the outside world, is a way to put cracks in the police state of slavery. And that's why the literate slave, is potentially the organizer of the non-literate slaves. So, yes, Solomon does protect the story of his literacy, and the film depicts that quite vividly, how he tries to make his own ink to be able to write, and then gets discovered, and that has terrible consequences for him.
Solomon Northup's father was a slave who was freed when his owner died, because the owner had directed that in his will. And Solomon Northup received an education. Mm-hmm. What do we know about the education he got, and how typical was education mm-hmm. for the children of slaves at that time in New York?
I don't think we know a great deal about Solomon Northup's education. There are claims that he was, fully literate and perhaps wrote his narrative, and then there are equal claims that he had an amanuensis and it was an as-told too. That he would get an education as a free black northerner in the state of New York, at least some modest education, is not that unusual. But most free blacks in a northern state like New York, or even in New England, to the extent they did get formal schooling and education, it either would have come through tutoring, or it would have come in schools created by black communities themselves, because there was almost nothing in the way of what in modern times we would call integrated education. There was almost no access whatsoever for free blacks in the northern states to formal schools. However, in northern black communities, especially in the cities and towns, they tended to create their own schools. These might be very modest. That might mean 2 years of education, 3 years, 5 years, 6 years. But black communities in the North, almost utterly segregated out of the mainstream life of northern communities, developed their own schools, their own churches especially, their own orphanages, and even their own associations, their own insurance companies, their own burial societies. They had to create a kind of even alternative economy to the extent they could.
There were laws from state to state about mm-hmm. whether it was legal or illegal or mm-hmm. mandatory to educate slaves. And I think there were, correct me if I'm wrong here, I think there were places in the North where you were legally required to teach slaves to read so that they could read the Bible. And uh-huh. there were states in the South where it was illegal to teach slaves to read or write, because that could prove to be dangerous, because the more the slave knew, the more they'd comprehend what was going on, and the more of a threat they would be to
right.
the whole institution of slavery.
Yeah, but Terry, there's a bit of mythology about that. There were such laws in the colonial period and up to the Revolution in some northern colonies and states about requiring young blacks to read so they could read the Bible. But most of that is all banished and gone by the turn of the 19th century. Blacks were even allowed to vote in most northern states until about 1800. The vote was taken away. The vote actually existed for black males, just to give you an example of a right they actually had that was then rescinded. New Jersey took the vote away in 1807. Connecticut took the vote away in 1818. New York took the vote away in 1821. The reason for that was that the free black population was growing and expanding. And so political rights were first restricted. Later, other kinds of liberties and rights were restricted. And eventually, some of the western states, what we call the Midwestern states, Indiana, Illinois, and so on, even Ohio, passed Negro exclusion laws. They tried to exclude even the right of blacks to settle within those states to an extent. Those were not very enforceable.
You edited and published two slave narratives that were never published before, that mm-hmm. were basically found by families. So mm-hmm. these are just like, these were raw documents, incredibly valuable that you found. And you were on the show a few years ago when right. your volume was published. Mm-hmm. And in our interview, we were talking about the story of Wallace Turnage, one of the two slaves whose memoirs you published. Mm-hmm. He was bought by a professional slave trader.
Yes.
And during the 6 months that Turnage was this man's property, right. his assignment was to basically organize slave auctions.
Mm-hmm.
And then
mm-hmm.
after 6 months, he was told, well, you're mm-hmm. in the next auction. Mm-hmm. Next time, you're going to be sold.
Mm-hmm.
Now, although that's not a moment of actual physical brutality, you're not describing his whipping, mm-hmm. that is such a disturbing
mm-hmm.
story. Just thinking psychologically of what it must have been like for this man to have to organize slave auctions for yeah. other men in his position and then have to basically organize his own sale. It's
yeah.
it's just mind-boggling.
Well, and you know, Frederick Douglass is probably the one who has said it best in his narrative. He describes how, over and over, he says, the worst part of slavery was not physical. It was not the beating. It was not having a bloody back. It was psychological. It was mental. It was what it did to your mind. It was the constant struggle to fight back with your mind, to find some way that you could still fashion a future, that you could still hope for a future, that you could still hope for some form of control over your body and your life and your mind.
My guest is David Blight, the director of the Center for the Study of Slavery, Resistance, and Abolition at Yale University. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is David Blight, and he is the director of Yale's Center for the Study of Slavery, Resistance, and Abolition. He's edited a couple of slave memoirs, and he's in the process of writing a biography of Frederick Douglass. And we're talking about some of the things that help set the context for the memoir 12 Years a Slave, which is the basis of the new film of the same name. There are a lot of monuments in the South to Civil War generals. Do you ever think that there should be, like, a national holiday to just remember the people who were brought here to be slaves or who were born into slavery or sold into slavery?
Yes. Because
the nice thing about holidays like that, even if it's not, like, a day off or something, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. the media, you know, schools use that yeah. as like yeah. an opportunity for discussion and reflection, and yeah. it seems to me it wouldn't be a bad idea to set aside a day a year yeah. where people just like mm-hmm. engage in, you know, remembrance yeah. and conversation yeah. about how that yeah. horrible institution has affected our country and to yeah. remember the people who suffered in it.
Well, I love the question, Terry, and we can think about it through the lens of Martin Luther King Day, but here's the problem. Martin Luther King Day, for good reasons, was established, but it commemorates not only, you know, the heroism and leadership of Dr. King, but it is essentially a remembrance of the civil rights movement, and to whatever extent it's still a serious commemoration for most Americans, it commemorates the civil rights movement, which almost all Americans have managed in one way or another, for better or worse, to make into a redemptive, triumphal story. Even the right wing in America, let's be honest, when they have to, will say they're for civil rights. But this other story, the slave trade, slavery, hundreds and hundreds of thousands, millions of people enslaved for generations, most of whom we will never know the names of. That's not as easy a story to commemorate, but it can be. It can be commemorated through all kinds of cultural expression. It can be commemorated through poetry and music and all forms of art, and it always has been. I remember once watching Toni Morrison do a reading from her great novel, Beloved. It was right after it came out, somewhere around 1989 or 90. And she had a huge audience, and the college students all lined up at the microphone, and they constantly kept asking Miss Morrison, why did you write this book that's all about the memory of slavery? What are you really trying to do with this character, Beloved? And on and on and on. And finally, she just sort of threw up her hands, and she said, look, we don't have a monument to the slaves. I want the book to be a monument to the slaves. And she said, that's enough questions. but her point was, we don't really have such a monument. Now, we're beginning to. We are beginning to. There are memorials now to black soldiers in the Civil War. There are ways in which slavery has been commemorated now quite effectively at some plantation houses, at some slave sites in the South. There are museums and state historical societies beginning to find ways to tell this story and commemorate it. In 2015, the big, new, great Museum of African American History and Culture will open on the Mall in Washington, D.C., but I would be all for a kind of National Remembrance Day of this story, if for no other reason than the simple fact that the United States, the Republic itself, was founded out of the system of slavery. It was founded and made in some ways by this system of human bondage and then by the racial system that followed it. American slaves, just to put it in economic terms, American slaves by the 1850s, by the time Solomon Northup gets out of Louisiana with his liberty, American slaves are the single largest financial asset in the entire American economy. Slaves by 1860 were worth approximately $3.5 billion. That was the largest single asset in the entire U.S. economy. That was worth more than all railroads, more than all manufacturing, all other assets combined. We need to keep telling this story because it, in part, made us who we were. In fact, you know, the Constitution is written and founded with this great silence about slavery at its base. The Declaration of Independence, that great document, our creeds that we're founded on, has always been there as that paradox we're trying to live up to. We wouldn't have had a Civil War without this. We wouldn't have had a Jim Crow system without this. And we wouldn't even be having some of the dilemmas we have today over federalism and over race and over the presence of a black president without the background of this story. But it's a problem in our culture because, to be quite blunt about it, most Americans want their history to be essentially progressive and triumphal. They want it to be a pleasing story. And if you go back to this story, it's not always going to please you, but it's a story you have to work through to find your way to something more redemptive.
Yeah, we want America to be the hero and Americans to be the heroes.
We love being the country that freed the slaves. Mm-hmm. We're not so fond of being the country that
owned them, right.
That had the yeah. biggest slave system on the planet. Mm-hmm. The only other place that compared to us was Brazil.
So finally, I should ask you for your capsule review of the movie adaptation of 12 Years a Slave.
I like the film very much. I'll tell you very quickly why. Slavery has only rarely ever been depicted effectively in Hollywood pictures. This film stays quite loyal to the narrative itself. It's accurate in that sense. And I guess I just have to say that... especially after the recent Tarantino film, Django Unchained, this is a very, very good corrective, if that's a safe term to use about an art form, but it's a very good corrective for a major motion picture in trying to depict the character of slavery. You watch him, you watch Solomon fall into these stages of despair and then try to survive. I found the story quite compelling and the making of the film quite effective. And as a historian, I'm usually prepared to be relatively disappointed by historical films.
David Blight, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Tara. It's great to be on your show.
David Blight directs the Center for the Study of Slavery, Resistance, and Abolition at Yale. He spoke to us from Cambridge University in England, where this year he's the William Pitt Professor of American History and Institutions. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Henry Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, John Sheehan, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. WHYY's chief content officer is Christine Dempsey. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Chevrolet, maker of the Volt, with electric technology to get there and fuel to go farther. Details at ChevyVolt.com. From Care.com, offering HomePay, a solution for nanny tax obligations from payroll tax to tax filings. Learn more at Care.com. And from Lumosity.com, with web-based brain games created by neuroscientists to improve memory and attention. Learn more at Lumosity.com. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, we feature our interview with musician Anat Cohen, who brought her clarinet to the studio. The new album, Tightrope, features the three Cohens, Anat and her brothers, saxophonist Yuval and trumpeter Avishai Cohen. Join us.